This show, Story in the Public Square, is built on one central insight, that stories have the power to change the world. Today's guest is a scholar of the impact stories have had on minds around the world and on human history itself. He's Martin Puchner this week on Story in the Public Square. Hello and welcome to Story in the Public Square, where storytelling meets public affairs. I'm Jim Lutis from the Pell Center at Salve Regina University. Alongside me is my friend and co-host G. Wayne Miller from the Providence Journal. Story in the Public Square is an effort to study, celebrate, and tell stories that matter, stories that shape public life in the United States and around the world. We do that by sitting down each week with storytellers and scholars to help us understand the power of narrative. This week, we're joined by a scholar whose work could not be any more perfectly aligned with the purpose of the show. Martin Puchner is professor of drama, English, and comparative literature at Harvard University, and the author of a new book, literally, about the power of story. Martin, thank you so much for being with us.
Thanks for having me.
So the book is The Written World, The Power of Stories to Shape People, History, Civilization, and it's won wonderful praise. Congratulations. Tell us a little bit about what the book is trying to do.
I think it's tapping exactly, as you said, into what this show is all about, namely to think about how stories, and in particular written stories, have shaped our world and are shaping our world today. And I think when a lot of people hear literature, they think of the fiction bookshelf, you know, in a bookstore, and that's fine, but it's something you go to when you are on a plane ride or something like that. But once I started to think of literature in a broader sense as important written stories, a much larger scope of stories came to my view, including important religious stories like the Bible and many other religious foundational texts, political stories like the Declaration of Independence or the Communist Manifesto, as well as important fictional stories that have been retold many times and have really become part of our culture. So that was the idea, to really look at the big scope of it, the story of literature, if you will.
So and you've got 16 specific texts that you're studying, and the history of literature, getting it down to 16 had to be a brutal and difficult process. Yes. How do you decide which 16 to include, and who was number 17?
It's very hard, but I didn't just want to select the 16 most important texts or my favorite texts. I wanted to tell a particular story, and that story had to do with the intersection of storytelling and writing technologies. And that's something that's, of course, born out of our experience. We are living through a revolution in writing technologies, the internet, and that's changing how literature is distributed, how it's read, how it's written, and also what kinds of stories are being written. So I wanted to look at the prehistory of that, what happened at earlier moments when new technologies changed the written world, and that narrowed down my selection. So I looked at an important text that intersected with some of these technologies, such as the alphabet or paper or print or certain formats like the book or the scroll. And so that made it a little easier, but still hard, but made it a little easier because there's a particular purpose to the selection.
So give us an example of one or two or three of the 16 works that you decided to focus on.
Well, I suppose if you tell a story, it's good to start at the beginning, and that's what I do with the invention of writing. Now, writing was invented not to write down stories, for very mundane, very different purposes, for accounting purposes.
Really?
It was a tool of tax collectors of these early states in Mesopotamia in today's Iraq.
So it wasn't to change the course of history or inspire other people?
No.
It was a practical device.
That's right. It was to extract taxes from them. But at
some things have never changed, right?
That's very true. But at some point, one of these early tax collectors or accountants started to use this new technology, namely to put words onto clay, in that case, for a different purpose, and that was to write down a story. And that is the beginning of my story, the intersection of writing technologies and storytelling. And I begin, therefore, with the first important text that comes out of that intersection, the Epic of Gilgamesh, written on these clay tablets, the first significant text of world literature.
So how did you do your research for that chapter, for example?
Yeah. So, you know, in that case, and it's true of a lot of the episodes that take place in the ancient world, of course I relied on, I don't read cuneiform, so I relied on a lot of experts and, you know, generations of scholars and translators, and I talked to them because I had edited an anthology of world literature. I had good connections to a lot of experts in the field, and I worked with them in dealing with areas of literature that I was not an expert in.
Did that fascinate you?
It was. I mean, that's...
sounds fascinating.
And it was such a story, for me, of discovery, really. And that was really thrilling. I mean, scary, but once I got over that, thrilling. And so I discovered a lot. And part of that had preceded by my work on the anthology of world literature, and the story of discovery started there, and then working with these experts, learning from them, delving into literature I had not read before, and I think that's something I tried to communicate in the book as well.
So thinking back to my undergraduate days when we read Gilgamesh, I recall that it is in some respects about the humanity's quest for immortality. How are you remembered? What is it, through great deeds, or is it, you know, how will you be remembered to live like the gods? That seems to be an eternal, you know, 10,000 years ago or 8,000 years ago, whenever Gilgamesh was actually recorded for the first time. That seems to be an impulse that still drives us today. Do you find that is the literature that you addressed all touched to speak to those sort of enduring human questions?
I think in one way or another. I mean, in Gilgamesh, it's interesting because it's tied to what we were talking about, namely writing. That writing is one of the things that makes a story endure. Epic of Gilgamesh begins with a celebration of writing in that way. And a lot of writers are quite conscious of that, that through written texts, you can anticipate the future. You're somehow addressing future readers, but you also know that you're text will endure, and so you communicate with the past and the future in interesting ways, and I think a lot of writers are aware of that. Now, I'd say there are some writers who emphasize the future more than the past, especially some of these political texts, the Declaration of Independence, the Communist Manifestos. They tell stories, some of them go back deep into history, but in order to create a new future. And I think a lot of storytelling is poised between those two perspectives, looking back, but also looking forward.
So a little later in history, you get into the teachings of Buddha and Confucius and Socrates and Jesus, particularly with Jesus and with the Buddha. There's a religious aspect here.
Right.
What is the unique power of storytelling in terms of shaping religious beliefs, in terms of finding disciples or followers?
Yeah.
You get into that in the book too. This is something more now than certainly accounting or talking about immortality. This is shaping people's belief systems and their lives.
These are texts that tell people how to live their lives, very much so. What was fascinating to me about this set of figures you mentioned, Confucius, the Buddha, Socrates, and Jesus, is that they arose more or less at the same time in the ancient world in some of the most literate cultures of the time. They gathered students and followers around them and taught different principles, different religions, different philosophies. But what they had in common is that none of them wrote a single word. They could have written, they lived in literate cultures, but they actually rejected writing and instead insisted on a kind of live, interactive relationship to their students and followers. Socrates was the most explicit. He criticized writing. He was worried that if once you write down stories and produce texts, they can be very easily taken out of context. You can't ask a text follow-up questions. He also worried that once we trust these external memory devices called written texts to remember things for us, we would no longer have to think to know things ourselves. So he was very worried about writing. He rejected it. He only spoke. But what happened with all of these charismatic teachers is that, of course, sooner or later they died. And then their students are faced with a dilemma. What to do, how to remember their teacher's words and deeds. And, you know, they start oral traditions of memory, but sooner or later they turn to writing and they produce new texts, precisely the text by which we now know about these teachers. But in a sense, you could say they betrayed their teachers, they betrayed, and as teachers, I know that all good students betray their teachers. they turned to writing and produced very interesting, very powerful texts in the process.
Are there common elements, common storytelling elements that you find across these different examples?
Well, especially across these four or five teachers, yes, because I feel like these students actually knew what they were doing. They knew that they're in some sense violating their teacher's anti-writing principles. So what they did is they produced very vivid, very dramatic texts, philosophical dialogues, very anecdotal texts that really showed their teachers interacting with their students. So these texts feel very different from the other texts we've talked about, like the Epic of Gilgamesh, or religious texts like the Hebrew Bible that are very layered, they're very writerly, they're difficult to read, whereas the texts produced by these students are much more dramatic and vivid and easier to read, and they address their readers and listeners in a much more direct way, and I think that's part of their power.
Are they mindful of the audience? Is that what I hear you saying?
I think they're very mindful of the audience, and they have a very dramatic understanding of that interaction between author and audience, because I think the teachers around which these writings revolve rejected writing altogether. They had this very direct relationship.
So fast forward to more modern times, we have political writing, and you examine the Communist Manifesto, for example. Talk about that, and that had a different kind of power, although it was also aimed at attracting believers.
It was, and it was a text explicitly meant to foster revolution. Now there are a million of such texts that arose in the first half of the 19th century. So why did the Communist Manifesto survive where many of these other texts fell by the wayside? And I think there are a couple of reasons, but one reason is the power of storytelling. Marx especially was a great storyteller, and he had a deep sense of history. So he essentially begins the manifesto with a brief history of mankind from a very particular perspective, namely the class struggle. But it's not just a kind of political program that he proposes. It's a story, and that really allowed its readers to place themselves in this grand historical narrative. And then he ends, of course, with a call of action, but it's supported by this grand story. And so that was part of the power. The other part of the power was organization. So Marx and Engels were part of this London-based underground organization, and that organization tried to translate the Communist Manifesto in many different languages. It took them a while to really realize that program, a couple of decades. And then the Communist Manifesto really took off. And then once the Russian Revolution happened, and the Russian people who engineered the Russian Revolution very much quoted the Communist Manifesto as their influence, it became world famous and feared around the world. Yeah.
I'm going to take a quick moment for station identification. This is Story in the Public Square, where storytelling meets public affairs. You can hear the show three times every weekend on Sirius XM Satellite Radio, the POTUS channel to be precise. That's the Politics of the United States, channel 124. We produce this show with the help of a remarkably talented crew at Rhode Island PBS in Providence, Rhode Island, and we're lucky to work with them. I'm Jim Lutis, the Executive Director of the Pell Center for International Relations and Public Policy at Salve Regina University in historic Newport, Rhode Island. You can always catch up with me on Twitter at JMLutis. My co-host is G. Wayne Miller, an award-winning journalist with the Providence Journal and author of 17 books. Wayne is on Twitter as well at G. Wayne Miller, all one word. And our guest this week is Martin Puchner, a professor of drama, English, and comparative literature at Harvard University. He's also the author of a new book, The Written World, The Power of Stories to Shape People, History, Civilization. You can find Professor Puchner on Twitter at Martin_PUCHNER. So Martin, You write about Benjamin Franklin, one of America's founding fathers, a journalist, a political leader, and you describe him as as having done pioneering work as a media entrepreneur. So in 1776, what does that mean for to be a media entrepreneur?
Yeah, in 1776, it means recognizing what the potential of the world of print into which Franklin is born. When he was born, there was a single newspaper in Boston in the colonies. By the time, in 1776, there are like, I think, 25 or 30 or even 35. So there's a real explosion, media explosion happening at the time, and Franklin is right at the center of it. He recognizes the power of it. And he's very, of course, he's a printer by training. He also developed a real, basically a media empire. He's interested in paper mills. He has a financial interest in paper mills. He even collected rags, the raw material out of which paper was made. He controlled print shops and newspapers and broadsides that were printed. He even had control over the postal roads on which printed matter was distributed. Wow. Among the 13 colonies. So really a vertical integration of a media empire. And I think he cared about it more than the content this media empire transported. He was, even though he was on the side of the revolutionaries, he was happy to print all kinds of opinions because he really believed in that kind of marketplace of ideas that was made possible by this world of print.
So we're talking Franklin, but I'm thinking Mark Zuckerberg. I mean, is that a reasonable analogy?
And that's what I was thinking. That's who I was thinking when I looked at Franklin and saw what he was doing. And you know, like Mark Zuckerberg, Franklin, I mean, he did write, but he often wrote, when he wrote, anonymously, and he didn't really publish anything under his own name. Even the autobiography of Benjamin Franklin was published after his death. So I think for him, for Franklin, it was really the platform that mattered more than content.
So if we had a time machine.
My mind is blown.
I know. No, really. I mean, I love Ben Franklin for all kinds of reasons, mm-hmm. and I have forever and ever and ever. If you could bring him back, if we had a time machine, we bring him back, meaning to 2018, what do you think he would think of the media landscape today?
I think he would embrace it. Because, you know, that's what he did at his time. He recognized what kind of genres work in print and which one didn't. So, for example, encyclopedias, they were new. He loved encyclopedias. He ended up buying a complete set of the French encyclopedia. So one of the Philadelphia newspapers he bought was publishing an extract from one of these encyclopedias with every issue. But Franklin realized that didn't make sense because an encyclopedia is there for cross-references, to look things up. You wanted to have a complete set. It didn't make sense to just over 10 years or something like that print one column each day. So he got rid of that and rethought the journal, rethought the content of the journal in keeping with its form, in keeping with the kind of medium that it was.
So we bring him back. How many Twitter followers
exactly
what do you have today? I'm going to guess
many.
2 million.
Yes, exactly.
Have you given any thought to how the technology of delivering a story is changes the way we as an audience receive a story, but also maybe the way we even think of the complexity with which we grapple with issues?
I think so. I mean, one of the through lines of these 4,000 years of literature is that with each of these new technologies, the cost of literature drops. Hmm. And as we know, once you drop the price, once you drop the cost of something, huge changes happen because suddenly new entrants into the market happen. More people read and write and tell stories. That means new stories occur. And that means that the whole landscape changes. This happens with paper, for example. I talk about how paper, when it was introduced in the Arabic world, led to the great story collection that we now know by the name of 1001 Nights. Popular stories that hadn't been written down before. And so I think that's what we are seeing today. These changes in the format or in the medium have huge influence.
It democratizes storytelling?
It democratizes storytelling. And that's often accompanied by kind of panic. Because, you know, traditional when print was introduced, the church, traditional universities, they suddenly had to compete. And they panicked. They thought the world was falling down. But it didn't. It was just reconfigured and a new equilibrium occurred, and we are at the beginning of another one of those revolutions, clearly, and we'll have to see how things shake out. But I don't think it will be the end of everything. It wasn't in the past.
So you mentioned that Franklin wrote an autobiography, and it wasn't published until after he died. Two recent presidents, in fact, the current president and the president prior to him, Barack Obama and Donald Trump, both wrote, before they ran for president, best-selling autobiographies.
Right.
Talk about that, because clearly that is an important part of telling your own story.
Right. No, and it's important. It was very interesting to me to wreck, because, of course, like probably everyone, I think there are huge differences among those two presidents.
Yes,
but then
are.
And I realized, looking at their career arc, that they did, as you say, publish these autobiographies at really crucial moments in their careers. I mean, for Trump, it came at a moment when he had real trouble with his media empire, with his real estate empire. And it was through the success of Art of the Deal that he could establish himself in the public eye as the deal maker. And then, of course, as we know, he parlayed that into his TV show, but he established that story through Art of the Deal, and it's the story that took him to the White House. And, you know, not dissimilarly with Obama. I first learned about Obama through Dreams from My Father, and it's a very different kind of text. It's sort of a searching immigrant biography of sorts, looking for his origins, thinking about his role in society, but both of these are variants of the American style autobiography that mixes personal history with some form of business success, and I think that goes back to the autobiography of Benjamin Franklin. So it just goes to show the extent to which written stories still matter, even in our media-saturated age.
And going back and reading both of those books, published again before they ran for or became president, you can see great insights into what they would be as president. I mean, they're totally different books. The style, as you mentioned, are different. Their personality is very different. That all comes through very clearly. You almost, in some sense, could have predicted some of their presidencies.
Absolutely. I agree.
I'm curious. So you in the written world, you're looking at 4,000 years of literature. We should also note that you're the editor of the Norton Anthology of World Literature. When you look at the role that narrative and storytelling plays in public life in the United States, in the West today, how do we compare, you know, in some sort of historical context?
Well, I think written stories have mattered for the last 4,000 years, and they matter today as much as at any previous time. It's just, it's changing. The stories change. I mean, right, we still have these established foundational texts like the autobiography, like religious texts, political texts, political narratives that get rewritten and retold at different times. But of course, there are also new stories that emerge. I mean, I think one of the striking features about the storytelling landscape today is young adult fiction. Harry Potter. It's amazing that you now have an entire generation that has grown up with Harry Potter. And looking at Harry Potter from that perspective, it's very interesting how Rowling mixes different story types. She, of course, goes back to the whole narrative of the Middle Ages, chivalric romances, and all of that. But she mixed that with a very different kind of story, namely a kind of the boarding school novel. And that way, she made that very remote and exotic and fantastic material suddenly relatable, especially to students who may not be in a boarding school, but they kind of fantasize about it. They can relate to the social dynamics of it. And that turned out to be a really potent combination.
And at least in my experience, in a classroom of college freshmen, at least 90% have read Harry Potter.
Absolutely. Yeah. And I think you know, some of my colleagues sneer at that, but I think it's great. I think you have to work with that.
Yeah. My kids all read it, and I was applauding that they did. So let's look at a different kind of storyteller, and that would be Vladimir Putin.
Mm-hmm.
And he tells a lot of stories. He tells the story of mighty Russia, that is this great economic power. And in fact, many of his people are living in poverty. Wow. And economically, Russia, I almost said the Soviet Union, but of course, he came from the Soviet Union, is struggling. And then, of course, there are the stories he tells either directly or indirectly that in some sense affected the 2016 election. Have you given any thought to Vladimir Putin as a storyteller?
Yeah, no, it's interesting. I mean, he, you know, the story he tells is of past glory and the betrayal of Russia's past glory by recent politicians, and he's trying to return to that. It's not that different from the story that Donald Trump is telling. You know, it's make Russia great again.
Mm-hmm. Oh, that's interesting.
And,
yeah.
And that, yeah. I think that it's just, that's a very powerful story. It's the story that was told in Germany after the Weimar Republic, that politicians had betrayed Germany, that's why Germany lost World War I. And that story was fueled, you know, Hitler is the one who told that story, and it took him to become who he became. So it's a story that pops up in different places, but that
But the power of the story that these leaders tell is really incredible,
yeah,
when you think about it.
It is. It is scary.
Is there a counter? I mean, so we're in an environment where truth is sort of a rare commodity. We talk about fake news, and we dismiss a lot of stuff now just because, like, well, where did that come from?
Right.
Is there a counter to political leaders who want to push that sort of counterfactual narrative?
Yeah. So I think that's the big task. I don't think you can oppose a story, a powerful story like the one Putin or Trump is telling with facts. You can only oppose it with a different story. And that's, I think, what we have to get better at.
Wow. I'm letting that kind of sink in. How do you tell that other kind of story?
I mean, if I knew, I would be telling it right now. So I think that it's not easy because it has to, you know, stories, it has to acknowledge the reality of people you want to convince with that story, whose experience you want to integrate into that story, but you want to end up in a different place.
Martin Pogner, your story is very interesting, and we thank you for being with us. The book is The Written World. You should check it out. That's all the time we have this week, but if you want to know more about Story in the Public Square, please connect with us on Facebook and Twitter, or else you can find us on pellcenter.org, where you can also watch previous episodes. For G. Wayne Miller, I'm Jim Lutis. We ask you to join us again next week for more Story in the Public Square.